His foot came down on a twig. The snap filled his ears, and he crouched, peering into the gloom with a desperate need that transcended sight. It felt as if a frantic power drove out of his eyes, propelled by his terror, demanding the mist be cloven so he could see. Obediently, it seemed, the dry fog suddenly fell open before him. Pupils dilated, Gordon saw that he was less than 2 meters from the window. His own face reflected, wide-eyed and wild-haired, and saw, superimposed on his own image, a vacant, skeletal death mask, a hooded skull grinning in welcome. Gordon crouched, hypnotized, as a superstitious thrill coursed up his spine. He was unable to bring his weapon to bear, unable to cause his larynx to make sound. The haze swirled as he listened for proof that he had really gone mad, wishing with all his might that the death's head was an illusion. Alas, poor Gordon! The sepulchral image overlay his reflection and seemed to shimmer a greeting. Never in all these awful years had death, owner of the world, manifested to him as a specter. Gordon's numbed mind could think of nothing but to attend the Elsinorean figure's bidding. He waited, unable to take his gaze away or even to move. The skull and his face and the skull. The thing had captured him without a fight, and now seemed content to grin about it. At last, it was something as mundane as a monkey reflex that came to Gordon's aid. No matter how mesmerizing, how terrifying, no unchanging sight can keep a man riveted forever. Not when it seemed that nothing at all was happening. Nothing changing. Where courage and education failed him, where his nervous system had let him down, boredom finally took command. His breath exhaled. He heard it whistle between his teeth. Without willing them to, Gordon felt his eyes turn slightly from the visage of death. A part of him noted that the window was set in a door. The handle lay before him. To the left, another window. To the right was the hood. The hood of a jeep. The hood of an abandoned, rusted jeep that lay in a faint rut in the forest gully. He blinked at the hood of the abandoned, rusted jeep with ancient U.S. government markings and the skeleton of a poor, dead civil servant within, skull pressed against the passenger side window, facing Gordon. The strangled sigh he let out felt almost ectoplasmic. The relief and embarrassment were so palpable. Gordon straightened up, and it felt like unwinding from a fetal position, like being born. "Oh, oh, Lordy," he said, just to hear his own voice. Moving his arms and legs, he paced a long circle around the vehicle, obsessively glancing at its dead occupant, coming to terms with its reality. He breathed deeply as his pulse settled and the roar in his ears gradually ebbed. Finally, he sat down on the forest floor with his back against the cool door on the jeep's left side. Trembling, he used both hands as he put the revolver back on safety and slid it into its holster. Then he pulled out his canteen and drank in slow, full swallows. Gordon wished he had something stronger, but water right now tasted as sweet as life. Night was full, the cold, bone-chilling. Still, Gordon spent a few moments putting off the obvious. He would never find the bandit's roost now, having followed a false clue so far into a pitch-dark wilderness. The jeep, at least, offered some form of shelter, better than anything else around. He hauled himself up and placed his hand on the door lever, calling up motions that had once been second nature to 200 million of his countrymen, and which, after a stubborn moment, forced the latch to give. The door let out a loud screech as he pulled hard and forced it open. He slid onto the cracked vinyl of the seat and inspected the interior. The jeep was one of those reversed, driver-on-the-right types the post office had used back in the once-upon-a-time of before the Doom War. The dead mailman, what was left of him, was slumped over on the far side. Gordon avoided looking at the skeleton for the moment. The storage area of the truck was nearly full with canvas sacks. The smell of old paper filled the small cabin at least as much as the faded odor of the mummified remains. With a hopeful oath, Gordon snatched up a metal flask from the shift well. It sloshed. To have held liquid for 16 years or more, it had to be well sealed. Gordon swore as he twisted and pried at the cap. He pounded it against the doorframe, then attacked it again. Frustration made his eyes tear, but at last he felt the cap give. Soon he was rewarded with a slow, rough turning, and then the heady, distantly familiar aroma of whiskey. Maybe I've been a good boy after all. Maybe there is indeed a God. He took a mouthful and coughed as the warming fire streamed down. 2 more small swallows, and he fell back against the seat, breathing almost a sigh. He wasn't ready yet to face removing the jacket draped over the skeleton's narrow shoulders. Gordon grabbed sacks, bearing the imprint U.S. Postal Service, and piled them about himself. Leaving a narrow opening in the door to let in fresh mountain air, he burrowed under the makeshift blankets with his bottle. At last, he looked over at his host, contemplating the dead civil servant's American flag shoulder patch. He unscrewed the flask, and this time raised the container toward the hooded garment. "Believe it or not, Mr. Postman, I always thought you folks gave good and honest service. Oh, people used you as whipping boys a lot, but I know what a tough job you all had. I was proud of you even before the war. But this, Mr. Mailman," he lifted the flask, "this goes beyond anything I'd come to expect. I consider my taxes very well spent." He drank to the postman, coughing a little, but relishing the warm glow. He settled deeper into the mail sacks and looked at the leather jacket, ribs serrating its sides, arms hanging loosely at odd angles. Lying still, Gordon felt a sad poignancy, something like homesickness. The jeep, the symbolic, faithful letter carrier, the flag patch, they recalled comfort, innocence, cooperation, an easy life that allowed millions of men and women to relax, to smile or argue as they chose, to be tolerant with one another, and to hope to be better people with the passage of time. Gordon had been ready today to kill and to be killed. Now he was glad that had been averted. They had called him Mr. Rabbit and left him to die. But it was his privilege, without their ever knowing it, to call the bandits countrymen and let them have their lives. Gordon allowed sleep to come and welcomed back optimism, foolish anachronism that it might be. He lay in a blanket of his own honor and spent the rest of the night dreaming of parallel worlds. 2. Snow and soot covered the ancient tree's broken branches and seared bark. It wasn't dead, not quite yet. Here and there, tiny shoots of green struggled to emerge, but they weren't doing well. The end was near. A shadow loomed, and a creature settled onto the drifts, an old, wounded thing of the skies, as near death as the tree. Pinions drooping, it laboriously began building a nest, a place of dying. Stick by stick, it pecked among the ruined wood on the ground, piling the bits higher until it was clear that it was not a nest at all. It was a pyre. The bloody, dying thing settled in atop the kindling and crooned soft music unlike anything ever heard before. A glow began to build, surrounding the beast soon in a rich, purple lambience. Blue flames burst forth, and the tree seemed to respond. Aged, ruined branches curled forward toward the heat like an old man warming his hands. Snow shivered and fell. The green patches grew and began to fill the air with a fragrance of renewal. It was not the creature in the pyre that was reborn, and even in sleep, that surprised Gordon. The great bird was consumed, leaving only bones. But the tree blossomed, and from its flowering branches, things uncurled and drifted off into the air. He stared in wonderment when he saw that they were balloons, airplanes, and rocket ships. Dreams. They floated away in all directions, and the air was filled with hope. 3. A camp robber bird, looking for blue jays to chase, landed on the jeep's hood with a hollow thump. It squawked, once for territoriality and once for pleasure, then began poking through the thick detritus with its beak. Gordon awakened to the tap-tapping sound. He looked up, bleary-eyed, and saw the gray-flanked bird through the dust-smeared window. It took him moments to remember where he was. The glass windshield, the steering wheel, the smell of metal and paper, all felt like a continuation of one of the night's most vivid dreams, a vision of the old days before the war. He sat dazedly for a few moments, sifting through feelings while the sleep images unraveled and drifted away, out of grasp. Gordon rubbed his eyes and presently began to consider his situation. If he hadn't left an elephant's trail on his way into this hollow last night, he should be perfectly safe right now. The fact that the whiskey had lain here, untouched for 16 years, obviously meant the bandits were lazy hunters. They had their traditional stalks and blinds, and had never bothered fully to explore their own mountain. Gordon felt a bit thick-headed. The war had begun when he was 18, a college sophomore, and since then there had been little chance to build a tolerance to 80-proof liquor. Added to yesterday's series of traumas and adrenaline rushes, the whiskey had left him cotton-mouthed and scratchy behind the eyelids. He regretted his lost comforts as much as ever. There would be no tea this morning, nor a damp washcloth, or a venison jerky for breakfast, no toothbrush. Still, Gordon tried to be philosophical. After all, he was alive. He had a feeling there would be times when each of the items stolen from him would be missed most of all. With any luck, the Geiger counter wouldn't fall into that category. Radiation had been one of his main reasons for going ever westward since leaving the Dakotas. He had grown tired of walking everywhere a slave to his precious counter, always afraid it would be stolen or would break down. Rumor had it that the West Coast had been spared the worst of the fallout, suffering more, instead, from plagues wind-borne from Asia. That had been the way with that strange war. Inconsistent, chaotic, it had stopped far short of the spasm everyone had predicted. Instead, it was more like a shotgun blast of one mid-scale catastrophe after another. By itself, any one of the disasters might have been survivable. The initial techno-war at sea and in space might not have been so terrible had it remained contained and not spilled over onto the continents. The diseases weren't as bad as in the Eastern Hemisphere, where the enemy's weapons went out of control in his own populace. They probably wouldn't have killed so many in America had the fallout zones not pushed crowds of refugees together and ruined the delicate network of medical services. And the starvation might not have been so awful had terrified communities not blocked rails and roads to keep out the germs. As for the long-dreaded atom, only a tiny fraction of the world's nuclear arsenals were used before the Slavic resurgence collapsed from within and the unexpected victory was declared. Those few score bombs were enough to trigger the 3-year winter, but not a century-long night that might have sent man the way of the dinosaurs. For weeks, it appeared that a great miracle of restraint had saved the planet. So it seemed. And indeed, even the combination, a few bombs, some bugs, and 3 poor harvests, would not have been enough to ruin a great nation, and with it a world. But there was another illness, a cancer from within. "Damn you forever, Nathan Holm," Gordon thought. Across a dark continent, it was a common litany. He pushed aside the mail sacks. Ignoring the morning chill, he opened his left belt pouch and pulled out a small package wrapped in aluminum foil, coated with melted wax. If there ever had been an emergency, this was one. Gordon would need energy to get through the day. 12 cubes of beef bouillon were all he had, but they would have to do. Washing down a bitter, salty chunk with a swig from his canteen, Gordon kicked open the left door of the jeep, letting several sacks tumble out onto the frosted ground. He turned to his right and looked at the muffled skeleton that had quietly shared the night with him. "Mr. Postman, I'm going to give you as close to a decent burial as I can manage with my bare hands. I know that's not much payment for what you've given me, but it's all I can offer." He reached over the narrow, bony shoulder and unlocked the driver's door. His moccasins slipped on the icy ground as he got out and stepped carefully around to the other side of the jeep. "At least it didn't snow last night. It's so dry up here that the ground ought to thaw enough for digging in a little while." The rusty right-hand door groaned as he pulled. It was tricky, catching the skeleton in an emptied mail sack as it pitched forward. Gordon somehow managed to get the bundle of clothes and bones laid out on the forest floor. He was amazed at the state of preservation. The dry climate had almost mummified the postman's remains, giving insects time to clean up without much mess. The rest of the jeep appeared to have been free from mold for all these years. First, he checked the mailman's apparel. Funny, why was he wearing a paisley shirt under his jacket? The garment, once colorful but now faded and stained, was a total loss. But the leather jacket was a wonderful find. If big enough, it would improve his chances immeasurably. The footgear looked old and cracked, but perhaps serviceable. Carefully, Gordon shook out the gruesome, dry remnants and laid the shoes against his feet. Maybe a bit large. But then, anything would be better than ripped camp moccasins. Gordon slid the bones out onto the mail sack with as little violence as he could manage, surprised at how easy it was. Any superstition had been burned out the night before. All that remained was a mild reverence and an ironic gratitude to the former owner of these things. He shook the clothes, holding his breath against the dust, and hung them on a ponderosa branch to wear out. He returned to the jeep. Aha! The mystery of the shirt is solved. Right next to where he had slept was a long-sleeved blue uniform blouse with Postal Service patches on the shoulders. It looked almost new, in spite of the years. One for comfort and another for the boss. Gordon had known postmen to do that, when he was a boy. One fellow, during the muggy afternoons of summer, had worn bright Hawaiian shirts as he delivered the mail. The postman had always been grateful for a cool glass of lemonade. Gordon wished he could remember his name. Shivering in the morning chill, he slipped into the uniform shirt. It was only a little bit large. "Maybe I'll grow to fill it out," he mumbled, joking weakly with himself. At 34, he probably weighed less than he had at 17. The glove compartment contained a brittle map of Oregon to replace the one he had lost. Then, with a shout, Gordon grabbed a small square of clear plastic. A scintillator! Far better than his Geiger counter, the little crystal would give off tiny flashes whenever its crystalline interior was struck by gamma radiation. It didn't even need power. Gordon cupped it in front of his eye and watched a few sparse flickerings caused by cosmic rays. Otherwise, the cube was quiescent. Now what was a pre-war mailman doing with a gadget like that? Gordon wondered idly as the device went into his pants pocket. The glove compartment flashlight was a loss, of course. The emergency flares were crumbled paste. The bag, of course. On the floor below the driver's seat was a large leather letter carrier's sack. It was dry and cracked, but the straps held when he tugged, and the flaps would keep out water. It wouldn't come close to replacing his lost Kelty, but the bag would be a vast improvement over nothing at all. He opened the main compartment, and bundles of aged correspondence spilled out, breaking into scattered piles as brittle rubber bands snapped apart. Gordon picked up a few of the nearest pieces. "From the mayor of Bend, Oregon, to the chairman of the School of Medicine, University of Oregon, Eugene." Gordon intoned the address as though he were playing Polonius. He flipped through more letters. The addresses sounded pompous and archaic. "Dr. Franklin Davis of the small town of Gilchrist sends, with the word urgent printed clearly on the envelope, a rather bulky letter to the Director of Regional Disbursement of Medical Supplies, no doubt pleading priority for his requisitions. Gordon's sardonic smile faded into a frown as he turned over one letter after another. Something was wrong here. He had expected to be amused by junk mail and personal correspondence, but there didn't seem to be a single advertisement in the bag. And while there were many private letters, most of the envelopes appeared to be on one or another type of official stationery. Well, there wasn't time for voyeurism anyway. He'd take a dozen or so letters for entertainment and use the backsides for his new journal. He avoided thinking about the loss of the old volume. 16 years, tiny scratchings, now doubtless being perused by that one-time stockbroker robber. It would be read and preserved, he was sure, along with the tiny volumes of verse he had carried in his pack, for he had misread Roger Septian's personality. Someday he would come and get them back. What was a U.S. Postal Service jeep doing out here anyway? And what had killed the postman? He found part of his answer around at the back of the vehicle. Bullet holes in the tailgate window, well grouped, midway up the right side. Gordon looked over to the Ponderosa. Yes, the shirt and the jacket each had two holes in the back of the upper chest area. The attempted hijacking or robbery could not have been pre-war. Mail carriers were almost never attacked, even in the late 80s depression riots, before the golden age of the 90s. Besides, a missing carrier would have been searched for until found. So, the attack took place after the one-week war. What was a mailman doing, driving alone through the countryside after the United States had effectively ceased to exist? How long afterward had this happened? The fellow must have driven off from his ambush, seeking obscure roads and trails to get away from his assailants. Maybe he didn't know the severity of his wounds, or simply panicked. But Gordon suspected that there was another reason the letter carrier had chosen to weave in and out of blackberry thickets to hide deep in forest depths. He was protecting his cargo, Gordon whispered. He measured the chance he'd black out on the road against the possibility of getting to help, and decided to cash the mail rather than try to live. So, this was a bona fide post-war postman, a hero of the flickering twilight of civilization. Gordon thought of the old-time ode of the mails. Neither sleet nor hail, and wondered at the fact that some had tried this hard to keep the light alive. That explained the official letters and the lack of junk mail. He hadn't realized that even a semblance of normality had remained for so long. Of course, a 17-year-old militia recruit was unlikely to have seen anything normal. Mob rule and general looting in the main disbursement centers had kept armed authority busy and attrited until the militia finally vanished into the disturbances it had been sent to quell. If men and women elsewhere were behaving more like human beings during those months of horror, Gordon never witnessed it. The brave story of the postman only served to depress Gordon. This tale of struggle against chaos by mayors and university professors and postmen had a what-if flavor that was too poignant for him to consider for long. The tailgate opened reluctantly after some prying. Moving mail sacks aside, he found the letter carrier's hat with its tarnished badge, an empty lunchbox, and a valuable pair of sunglasses lying in thick dust atop a wheel well. A small shovel intended to help free the jeep from road ruts would now help to bury the driver. Finally, just behind the driver's seat, broken under several heavy sacks, Gordon found a smashed guitar. A large-caliber bullet had snapped its neck. Near it, a large, yellowed plastic bag held a pound of desiccated herbs that gave off a strong, musky odor. Gordon's recollection hadn't faded enough to forget the aroma of marijuana. He had envisioned the postman as a middle-aged, balding, conservative type. Gordon now recreated the image and made the fellow look more like himself. Wiry, bearded, with a perpetual stunned expression that seemed about to say, "Oh, wow!" A neo-hippie, perhaps. a member of a sub-generation that had hardly begun to flower before the war snuffed it out and everything else optimistic. A neo-hippie dying to protect the establishment's mail. It didn't surprise Gordon in the slightest. He had had friends in the movement, sincere people, if maybe a little strange. Gordon retrieved the guitar strings, and for the first time that morning felt a little guilty. The letter carrier hadn't even been armed. Gordon remembered reading once that the U.S. mail operated across the lines for 3 years into the 1860s Civil War. Perhaps this fellow had trusted his countrymen to respect that tradition. Post-chaos America had no tradition but survival. In his travels, Gordon had found that some isolated communities welcomed him in the same way minstrels had been kindly received far and wide in medieval days. In others, wild varieties of paranoia reigned. Even in those rare cases where he had found friendliness, where decent people seemed willing to welcome a stranger, Gordon had always, before long, moved on. Always, he found himself beginning to dream again of wheels turning and things flying in the sky. It was already mid-morning. His gleanings here were enough to make the chances of survival better without a confrontation with the bandits. The sooner he was over the pass, then, and into a decent watershed, the better off he would be. Right now, nothing would serve him half so well as a stream, somewhere out of the range of the bandit gang, where he could fish for trout to fill his belly. One more task here. He hefted the shovel. Hungry or not, you owe the guy this much. He looked around for a shady spot with soft earth to dig in, and a view. 4.
They said, "Fear not, Macbeth, till Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane. And now, a wood comes to Dunsinane. Arm, arm, arm yourselves. If this is what the witch spoke of, that thing out there, there'll be no running or hiding here."
Gordon clutched his wooden sword, contrived from planking and a bit of tin. He motioned to an invisible aide-de-camp.
"I'm getting weary of the sun and wish the world were undone. Ring the alarm bell. Blow, wind, come rack. At least we'll die with harness on our back."
Gordon squared his shoulders, flourished his sword, and marched Macbeth off stage to his doom. Out of the light of the tallow lamps, he swiveled to catch a glimpse of his audience. They had loved his earlier acts, but this bastardized one-man version of Macbeth might have gone over their heads. An instant after he exited, though, enthusiastic applause began, led by Mrs. Adele Thompson, the leader of this small community. Adults whistled and stamped their feet. Younger citizens clapped awkwardly, those below 20 years of age watching their elders and slapping their hands awkwardly as if they were taking part in this strange rite for the first time. Obviously, they had liked his abbreviated version of the ancient tragedy. Gordon was relieved. To be honest, some parts had been simplified less for brevity than because of his imperfect memory of the original. He had last seen a copy of the play almost a decade ago, and that a half-burned fragment. Still, the final lines of his soliloquy had been canon. That part about wind and rack he would never forget. Grinning, Gordon returned to take his bows on stage. A plank-covered garage lift in what had once been the only gas station in the tiny hamlet of Pine View. Hunger and isolation had driven him to try the hospitality of this mountain village of fenced fields and stout log walls, and the gamble had paid off better than he'd hoped. An exchange of a series of shows for his meals and supplies had tentatively passed by a fair majority of the voting adults, and now the deal seemed settled.
"Bravo! Excellent!"
Mrs. Thompson stood in a front row, clapping eagerly. White-haired and bony, but still robust, she turned to encourage the 40-odd others, including small children, to show their appreciation. Gordon did a flourish with one hand and bowed deeper than before. Of course, his performance had been pure crap, but he was probably the only person within 100 miles who had once minored in drama. there were peasants once again in America, and like his predecessors in the minstrel trade, Gordon had learned to go for the unsubtle in his shows. Timing his final bow for the moment before the applause began to fade, Gordon hopped off the stage and began removing his slapdash costume. He had set firm limits. There would be no encore. His stock was theater, and he meant to keep them hungry for it until it was time to leave.
"Marvelous! Just wonderful!"
Mrs. Thompson told him as he joined the villagers, now gathering at a buffet table along the back wall. The older children formed a circle around him, staring in wonderment. Pine View was quite prosperous, compared with so many of the starveling villages of the plains and mountains. In some places, a good part of a generation was nearly missing, due to the devastating effects the 3-year winter had had on children. But here he saw several teenagers and young adults, and even a few oldsters who must have been past middle age when the doom fell. They must have fought to save everybody. That pattern had been rarer, but he had seen it, too, here and there. Everywhere there were traces of those years, faces pocked from diseases or etched from weariness and war. 2 women and a man were amputees, and another looked out of one good eye, the other a cloudy mass of cataracts. He was used to such things, at least on a superficial level. He nodded gratefully to his host. "Thank you, Mrs. Thompson. I appreciate kind words from a perceptive critic. I'm glad you liked the show."
"No, no, seriously," the clan leader insisted, as if Gordon had been trying to be modest. "I haven't been so delighted in years. The Macbeth part at the end there sent shivers up my spine. I only wish I'd watched it on TV back when I had a chance. I didn't know it was so good. And that inspiring speech you gave us earlier, that one of Abraham Lincoln's, well, you know, we tried to start a school here in the beginning, but it just didn't work out. We needed every hand, even the kids. Now, though, well, that speech got me to thinking. We've got some old books put away. Maybe now's the time to give it a try again."
Gordon nodded politely. He had seen this syndrome before. The best of the dozen or so types of reception he had experienced over the years, but also among the saddest. It always made him feel like a charlatan when his shows brought out grand, submerged hopes in a few of the decent older people who remembered better days, hopes that, to his knowledge, had always fallen through before a few weeks or months had passed. It was as if the seeds of civilization needed more than good will and the dreams of aging high school graduates to water them. Gordon often wondered if the right symbol might do the trick, the right idea. But he knew his little dramas, however well received, weren't the key. They might trigger a beginning, once in a great while, but local enthusiasm always failed soon after. He was no traveling messiah. The legends he offered weren't the kind of sustenance needed in order to overcome the inertia of a dark age. "The world turns, and soon the last of the old generation will be gone. Scattered tribes will rule the continent. Perhaps in 1,000 years the adventure will begin again. Meanwhile..." Gordon was spared hearing more of Mrs. Thompson's sadly unlikely plans. The crowd squeezed out a small, silver-haired black woman, wiry and leather-skinned, who seized Gordon's arm in a friendly, vice-like grip.
"Now, Adele," she said to the clan matriarch, "Mr. Krantz hasn't had a bite since noontime. I think if we want him able to perform tomorrow night, we'd better feed him, right?"
She squeezed his right arm and obviously thought him undernourished, an impression he was loath to alter, with the aroma of food wafting his way. Mrs. Thompson gave the other woman a look of patient indulgence.
"Of course, Patricia," she said. "I'll speak with you more about this later, Mr. Krantz, after Mrs. Howlett has fattened you up a bit."
Her smile and her glittering eyes held a touch of intelligent irony, and Gordon found himself reevaluating Adele Thompson. She certainly was nobody's fool. Mrs. Howlett propelled him through the crowd. Gordon smiled and nodded as hands came out to touch his sleeve. Wide eyes followed his every movement. "Hunger must make me a better actor. I've never had an audience react quite like this before.
I wish I knew exactly what it was I did that made them feel this way.
One of those watching him from behind the long buffet table was a young woman barely taller than Mrs. Howlett, with deep, almond eyes and hair blacker than Gordon remembered ever seeing before. Twice she turned to gently slap the hand of a child who tried to help himself before the honored guest. Each time, the girl quickly looked back at Gordon and smiled. Beside her, a tall, burly young man stroked his reddish beard and gave Gordon a strange look, as if his eyes were filled with some desperate resignation. Gordon had only a moment to assimilate the two as Mrs. Howlett pulled him over in front of the pretty brunette.
"Abby," she said, "let's have a little bit of everything on a plate for Mr. Krantz. Then he can make up his mind what he wants seconds of. I baked the blueberry pie, Mr. Krantz."
Dizzily, Gordon made a note to have two helpings of the blueberry. It was hard to concentrate on diplomacy, though. He hadn't seen or smelled anything like this in years. The odors distracted him from the disconcerting looks and touching hands. There was a large, spit-turned, stuffed turkey, a huge, steaming bowl of boiled potatoes dollied up with beer-soaked jerky, carrots, and onions was the second course. Down the table, Gordon saw apple cobbler and an opened barrel of dried apple flakes.
"I must cousin a supply of those before I leave."
Skipping further inventory, he eagerly held out his plate. Abby kept watching him as she took it. The big, frowning redhead suddenly muttered something indecipherable and reached out to grab Gordon's right hand in both of his own. Gordon flinched, but the taciturn fellow would not let go until he answered the grip and shook hands firmly. The man muttered something too low to follow, nodded, and let go. He bent to kiss the brunette quickly and then stalked off, eyes downcast. Gordon blinked.
Did I just miss something?
It felt as if some sort of event had just occurred and had gone completely over his head.
"That was Michael, Abby's husband," Mrs. Howlett said. "He's got to go and relieve Edward at the trap string, but he wanted to stay to see your show first. When he was little, he so used to love to watch TV shows."
Steam from the plate rose to his face, making Gordon quite dizzy with hunger. Abby blushed and smiled when he thanked her. Mrs. Howlett pulled him over to take a seat on a pile of old tires.
"You get to talk to Abby later," the black woman went on. "Now you eat. Enjoy yourself."
Gordon did not need to be encouraged. He dug in while people looked on curiously, and Mrs. Howlett rattled on.
"Good, isn't it? You just sit and eat and pay us no mind. And when you're all full and you're ready to talk again, I think we'd all like to hear one more time how you got to be a mailman."
Gordon looked up at the eager faces above him. He hurriedly took a swig of beer to chase down the two hot potatoes.
"I'm just a traveler," he said, around a half-full mouth while lifting a turkey drumstick. "It's not much of a story how I got the bag and clothes."
He didn't care whether they stared or touched or talked at him so long as they let him eat. Mrs. Howlett watched him for a few moments, then, unable to hold back, she started in again.
"You know, when I was a little girl, we used to give milk and cookies to the mailman, and my father always left a little glass of whiskey on the fence for him the day before New Year's. Dad used to tell us that poem, you know, through sleet, through mud, through war, through blight, through bandits, and through darkest night."
Gordon choked on a sudden wayward swallow. He coughed and looked up to see if she was in earnest. A glimmer in his forebrain wanted to dance over the old woman's accidentally magnificent misremembrance. It was rich. The glimmer faded quickly, though, as he bit into the delicious roast fowl. He hadn't the will to try to figure out what the old woman was driving at.
"Our mailman used to sing to us."
The speaker, incongruously, was a dark-haired giant with a silver-streaked beard. His eyes seemed to mist as he remembered.
"We could hear him coming on Saturdays when we were home from school, sometimes when he was over a block away. He's black. A lot blacker than Mrs. Howlett or Jim Horton over there. Man, did he have a nice voice? Guess that's how he got the job. He brought me all those mail-order coins I used to collect, ring the doorbell so he could hand them to me personal with his own hand.
His voice was hushed with telescoped awe.
Our mailman just whistled when I was little, said a middle-aged woman with a deeply lined face. She sounded a little disappointed. But he was real nice. Later, when I was grown up, I came home from work one day and found out the mailman had saved the life of one of my neighbors, heard him choking, and gave him mouth-to-mouth until the ambulance came.
A collective sigh rose from the circle of listeners as if they were hearing the heroic adventures of a single ancient hero. The children listened in wide-eyed silence as the tales grew more and more embroidered. At least, the small part of him still paying attention figured they had to be. Some were simply too far-fetched to be believed. Mrs. Howlett touched Gordon's knee.
Tell us again how you got to be a mailman.
Gordon shrugged a little desperately.
I just found the mailman's things,
he emphasized, around the food in his mouth. The flavors had overcome him, and he felt almost panicky over the way they all hovered over him. If the adult villagers wanted to romanticize their memories of men they had once considered lower-class civil servants at best, that was all right. Apparently they associated his performance tonight with the little touches of extroversion they had witnessed in their neighborhood letter carriers when they had been children. That, too, was okay. They could think anything they damned well pleased, so long as they didn't interrupt his eating.
Ah.
Several of the villagers looked at each other knowingly and nodded, as if Gordon's answer had had some profound significance. Gordon heard his own words repeated to those on the edges of the circle.
He found the mailman's things, so naturally he became...
His answer must have appeased them, somehow, for the crowd thinned as the villagers moved off to take polite turns at the buffet. It wasn't until much later, on reflection, that he perceived the significance of what had taken place there, under boarded windows and tallow lamps, while he crammed himself near to bursting with good food. 5. We have found that our clinic has an abundant supply of disinfectants and painkillers of several varieties. We hear these are in short supply in Bend and in the relocation centers up north. We're willing to trade some of these, along with a truckload of deionizing resin columns that happened to be abandoned here, for 1,000 doses of tetracycline to guard against the bubonic plague outbreak to the east. Perhaps we'd be willing to settle for an active culture of vallomycine-producing yeast instead, if someone could come up and show us how to maintain it. Also, we are in desperate need of... The mayor of Gilchrist must have been a strong-willed man to have persuaded his local emergency committee to offer such a trade. Hoarding, however illogical and uncooperative, was a major contributor to the collapse. It astonished Gordon that there still had been people with this much good sense during the first 2 years of the chaos. He rubbed his eyes. Reading wasn't easy by the light of a pair of homemade candles, but he found it difficult getting to sleep on the soft mattress, and damn if he'd sleep on the floor after so long dreaming of just such a bed in just such a room. He had been a little sick earlier. All that food and home-brewed ale had almost taken him over the line from delirious happiness to utter misery. Somehow, he had teetered along the boundary for several hours of blurrily remembered celebration before at last stumbling into the room they had prepared for him. There had been a toothbrush waiting on his nightstand and an iron tub filled with hot water. And soap. In the bath, his stomach had settled, and a warm, clean glow spread over his skin. Gordon smiled when he saw that his postman's uniform had been cleaned and pressed. It lay on a nearby chair. The rips and tears he had crudely patched were now neatly sewn. He could not fault the people of this tiny hamlet for neglecting his one remaining longing, something he had gone without too long to even think about. Enough. This was almost paradise. As he lay in a sated haze between a pair of elderly but clean sheets, waiting leisurely for sleep to come, he read a piece of correspondence between two long-dead men. The mayor of Gilchrist went on. "We are having extreme difficulty with local gangs of survivalists. Fortunately, these infestations of egotists are mostly too paranoid to band together. They're as much trouble to each other as to us, I suppose. Still, they are becoming a real problem. Our deputy is regularly fired on by well-armed men in army surplus camouflage clothing. No doubt the idiots think he's a Russian lackey or some such nonsense. They have taken to hunting game on a massive scale, killing everything in the forest and doing a typically rotten job of butchering and preserving the meat. Our own hunters come back disgusted over the waste, often having been shot at without provocation.